United States against McCoy. Mr. Tassif.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is George Tassif. I'm with the Federal Public Defender's Office in Peoria, Illinois. I appear today on behalf of Darrell McCoy. I also served as Mr. McCoy's trial counsel in the district court below. Four separate issues are raised. I want to confine my remarks, if your honors permit, to the first and the third issues. The first issue being whether the district court abused its discretion in allowing government counsel to elicit prior consistent statements of one Clotia Hudson that she had observed Mr. McCoy in possession of a handgun on his person at her mother's residence. The factual chronology of events set forth in the briefs, what the government counsel did at trial is elicit from Ms. Hudson her trial version of what occurred, that being Mr. McCoy lifted up his hoodie sweatshirt and revealed the gun in his waistband. He then gave her the gun, which she accepted, placed on the floor, and later that morning pushed it underneath the couch where the officer ultimately found it. In anticipation of my cross-examination, government counsel then directed Ms. Hudson's testimony to the prior written statement that she gave the police at the police department that morning following her arrest. That statement is contained on page 10 of the appendix. And in that statement, she does not affirmatively say she ever saw the gun. She merely says she got up from the couch, went to a different room. That is when she thinks he put the gun underneath the couch.
So that impeaches her.
Pardon?
That impeaches her.
It impeaches her. So one
and
could argue.
Can't the prosecutor impeach his own witness?
Indeed. And as government counsel is arguing, anticipatorily, the government sought to soothe some of the sting by bringing it out through her. But then, this third statement that was elicited, government counsel then directed her attention to a statement that she gave a police detective 1 week later, at which time she said, and this is on page 77 of the trial transcript, she told the detective the truth about everything. I told him that Darrell had the gun, but she said it was Mr. McCoy who put the gun under the couch, not her.
And so that, again, impeaches her trial testimony.
That portion about who put the gun underneath the couch, but here she is affirmatively saying she saw Mr. McCoy in possession of the gun, consistent with her trial testimony, made at a point 1 week later when we contended the motive to fabricate had arisen. So that is where I think even government counsel acknowledges a problem with that prior statement being elicited, because it would be consistent with her trial testimony that she affirmatively observed the gun in his waistband. And then the coup de grace, as far as we were concerned, and that's when we had the sidebar and I was objecting on every grounds I could think of, that's when they elicited her testimony about grand jury testimony, at which time she states again, that's when I told the truth that I'm the one who put the gun under the couch. Our position is that these prior statements, and especially that third statement given to the detective 1 week later, served to improperly bolster her already shaky trial testimony in a way that the Supreme Court in Tomey versus U.S. said is not permitted under 801D2B of the Federal Rules of Evidence. And for that reason, we respectfully submit.
Did you ever tell the district judge that you were not planning to bring out Hudson's prior inconsistent statements?
Of course not. In fact, I didn't bring that out until I began my cross, and then we brought out the prior statement.
The reason I ask this is because there's no way to separate the inconsistent portion of her statement from the consistent portion. So if the defense plan was to bring out the inconsistency, it's also going to bring out the consistency that McCoy arrived with a gun. You can't do one but not the other.
The written statement, though, Your Honor, that she gave on the morning of her arrest does not acknowledge seeing the gun. It merely says that's when she thought he put the gun. It's this statement made to the detective a week later where she affirmatively says she saw the gun and it was McCoy. It's that second portion that could have been elicited without the first. again, they're piling on versions to establish a consistency that she saw him with the gun.
Do one without the other. The prosecutor is going to invoke the rule of completeness and put in the whole statement.
The prosecutor, if that was their theory at trial, could have said, now with respect to this statement you gave to the detective 1 week later, who did you say put the gun? Whom did you say put the gun under the couch? And omit that portion that is consistent about her direct observation of him.
Didn't your opening statement suggest that you would be bringing out inconsistent statements that she had given?
I said her testimony would be inconsistent. I did not go into detail in the opening statement, of course. But again, I didn't get a chance to cross-examine her until all four of these versions were coming out, one after another.
So strategically, you wanted to have a chance to bring those out first.
Well, obviously the government, this court has ruled that the government can, in anticipation of defense counsel's cross, bring things out that are not for the truth of the matter asserted, and would anticipate the impeachment. But to bolster the witness by having her recount a prior version given the police that squares with what she said in court. And this is where the direct observation, her observation of him having the gun on his person, that I respectfully submit is the vice that we are complaining of here. That's the consistency that she gave that arose after her motive to fabricate or to shift blame to Mr. McCoy would have arisen. And therein is the Tomey violation that we're asserting. Now, later in the case, Vernon Lee, a convicted felon, takes the witness stand. And his testimony elicits, by the government, the contents of a conversation he had with Ms. Hudson. I objected to that on grounds of hearsay. The court overruled on the grounds of excited utterance. I respectfully concede, as counsel has argued, my opposing counsel has argued on issue two, that the contents of the conversation most likely constitutes an excited utterance, given the circumstances under which it was made. But then we respectfully submit the admission of that testimony. The court denied me the opportunity to cross-examine Vernon Lee with a version he had given as to the contents of that conversation just a month earlier to FBI agents in preparation for trial. The court cut me off immediately, and the government counsel was objecting that this witness would not adopt that prior statement. Therefore, the Jenks Act prohibited me from crossing the witness about an inconsistent version. His trial testimony was that Clotilla Hudson had firmly told him, he's got a gun, what should I do? Tells the FBI a month before trial, she said that she thinks he has a gun. Very similar to her earlier written statement to the police that we were contesting as well. So we see a qualitative difference between the two, and I attempted to bring that out as a prior inconsistent statement, which this court characterized in Smith versus Furman as a prototypical form of impeachment. And we were forbidden to do that at all, and I made an offer of proof where, indeed, we established where I was going with this, and the district court denied my grounds by my objection or my attempt at cross on Jenks Act grounds, and we were denied that. With time permitting, if I may just address that fourth issue, the motion for new trial, weeks after the trial, we find out about Clotilla Hudson's involvement with a man named Cash Lee, a relative of Vernon Lee and Kendrick Lee and other Lee members who testified at our trial. She had lived with the man for some time, along with another individual named DRH. She provided the household out of which they were selling drugs and distributing ounce quantities of crack cocaine. Just 5 months before Mr. McCoy's arrest in this case of February 07, just 5 months earlier, she was involved in a traffic stop. 3 months earlier, in November of 06. Cash Lee gave her 2 ounces of crack, which she secreted on her person. She gave 6 grams of crack to DRH. DRH was arrested when he dropped his 6 grams. She got rid of her 2 ounces. No one knew about this until Mr. Mahochko, the prosecutor, was conducting a proffer with Cash Lee in preparation for another trial. We respectfully submit that this information could have provided us the basis for challenging her testimony in a very vigorous way by establishing a theory of defense that if anyone had a motive, and an opportunity and a lack of mistake to have a gun to protect drugs, either on her own behalf or that of others, it would have been Clotilda Hudson and not Mr. McCoy. So for all these reasons, we are asking this court to reverse Mr. McCoy's conviction and remand for a new trial.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Mullen.
May it please the court, Linda Mullen on behalf of the United States. I, too, plan to focus my brief comments this morning on the issue of prior consistent statements and then touch very briefly on the issue of Vernon Lee and the cross-examination. And I think Mr. Tassif has accurately explained exactly what happened below. I think where we differ is on the emphasis or the focus on this prior motive to testify, because the government brought out the prior consistent statements or the part of her statements that happened to be consistent with the trial testimony in an effort to rehabilitate her. So this was not something where – this was not a situation where the government had to meet the requirements under Tomey or Tome for the motive to testify. So that was the difference. And again, the government did bring that out on direct as it is permitted to do. And then in terms of bringing out the complete statement, asked her about everything that she had said the night of the offense and a week later. It seems that Mr. Tassif is focusing most on that statement to the detective, but again, part of that statement was inconsistent. The only part that was inconsistent throughout was who put that gun under the couch. So that's why the government brought that in, and it was entirely permissible as proper rehabilitation. With respect to the Vernon Lee testimony.
Ms. Hudson is the absolute critical witness to your case, though, isn't she?
She's
the only one that puts him in possession of the gun.
That's right. She was a very important witness to the government. She did put him in possession of the gun. Of course, there is corroboration of her testimony with respect to the phone call to Vernon Lee, Vernon Lee testifies that she says, he has a gun, what do I do? She's in a panic situation at that point.
Vernon Lee never saw the gun. No one else saw the gun. Other than Clotilda Hudson.
That's right. The police officers, of course, found the gun directly under the couch where the defendant had been sitting, and the government also established a motive for him to have the gun. I think it was this court in the Beard case that talked about how confidence in a proposition like the defendant's guilt is created by excluding alternatives, and that's one thing that the prosecution attempted to do here by having the two occupants of the house who were upstairs sleeping, Williamson and Thomas, testify that the gun was not theirs. They did not allow guns in the house. They had never seen that gun before. And the other way that there's a confidence in a proposition such as the defendant's guilt, one thing the defendant would try to do is present plausible alternatives. Only that didn't happen here. I mean, the only story that the jury heard, the only version of events that the jury heard here, was that it was McCoy's gun, that McCoy was the one who had the motive to have the gun, that the gun was under the couch where McCoy was sitting, that the phone call with Vernon Lee, there was a stipulation, of course, that phone call did occur. There were phone records, stipulation that it occurred at that time of night, and that Vernon Lee testified that at the time Hudson said, he's here, he has a gun, I don't know what to do, because he's clearly in major physical distress, perhaps not breathing, but if I call the police, I'm afraid they're going to find this gun. So there was sufficient corroboration. Her testimony was important. But again, our position, Judge Tinder, is that those comments that came in, those prior consistent comments, were entirely admissible. Not so sure about the grand jury testimony, but at that point, I think it was the First Circuit in the Simonelli case had very, very similar facts where the government had presented the earlier statements, the earlier consistent statements that were part of a larger statement that contained inconsistent statements as well, and then on top of that put in grand jury testimony where there was no inconsistency. First Circuit found that the grand jury testimony portion of it was probably inadmissible, but under harmless error said this was really just another helping of what the jury had already had for dinner. They'd already heard this several times before, so at that point it was cumulative. Turning, if I may, for a moment to the Vernon Lee issue, the record is just a little muddled on this. As we point out in our brief, it's not exactly clear to us what was going on in the courtroom or whether or not there was a meeting of the minds between Judge McDade and Mr. Tassif in terms of what Mr. Tassif was attempting to do and what Judge McDade wanted him to do. Excuse me, in terms of laying a foundation. But what we do think is clear is that this was such a minor hair-splitting point, whether or not Vernon Lee had said to the FBI officer that Hudson said she thought he, that the full statement was she thought he had a gun and didn't know what else, or whether she had in fact said he had a gun. Clearly implicit in the entire statement to begin with is this sense that she didn't know what else implies that she did know he had the gun, and certainly Vernon Lee responded in such a way as to suggest that his understanding of what she was saying was that she was that the defendant had a gun, because he didn't say, well, you should discern whether or not he has a gun, investigate that, and then let's talk some more. He said, hide the gun and call 911 or let him die. So clearly Vernon Lee understood that that's what she was saying. And to the extent that, Mr. Tassif should have been allowed to ask the question, we would submit as harmless error on the facts of this case. If the panel has no questions for me, I will return the balance of my time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement. Our next case for argument.